Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the integrity of our country's elections. Even before the debacle in Iowa, my guest, Richard Hassan, has been sounding the alarm about the problems with our voting systems. There are the real threats, cyber attacks, human incompetence, and then there are the manufactured ones, persistent and false accusations of voter fraud. Hassan argues these risks, both legitimate and perceived, are working to undermine the faith in our country's ability to hold a free and fair election. His new book is titled Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick Hassan, the name of your book, Election Meltdown, sounds pretty serious. Tell us what you mean.
Well, I'm trying to sound the alarm, you know, so if it sounds like things are not this bad, what I would say is just like if you ran a nuclear power plant, you might take exceptional steps to avoid a catastrophe, even if the catastrophe was a relatively small chance. Same thing here. We've got all kinds of legal problems, technological problems, social problems, political problems, all of them together leading to the chances that come November 2020, the losers might not accept the results of the American election as legitimate. And of course, a democracy depends on the losers accepting the results and saying, okay, we lost, we'll fight again next time. And so we're at a really precarious position in our democracy, I think, where the very way that we run our election is under question. And so I want to point out why there's this increasing mistrust in our election process and maybe what we can do about it in time for the 2020 elections.
Let's start with the tech part. I want to know about voting machines because there have been so many concerns expressed by people about the manufacturers, and I want to know what your investigations have shown.
Well, there certainly is a lot of concern about voting machines because just about everywhere, voting machines are made by private companies and they're bought in contracts that states or counties will make with these companies. And some of the machines are not very good. Some of the machines have problems. There's concern about them being deliberately manipulated. And I think the way to respond to that is to have good procedures in place to catch any kind of manipulation. Remember, in 2000, we had that terrible election between Bush and Gore, and we got rid of those terrible punch card voting machines, and we replaced them with better machines. But in a lot of places, there were machines that didn't produce any paper. And so the concern was, you know, you have this voting machine, it just produces a computer record, and how do we know it's not hacked? And so now, almost everywhere, they're moving to paper as the result. So you could do an audit and make sure that the count is correct. But even there, there's a concern. The latest wave of machines are called ballot marking devices, or BMDs. And what those are you fill out your ballot electronically on a screen, you make your choices, and then the machine prints a ballot. And then that's the official ballot. So you could, you know, do a recount with the paper that comes out. The problem is that in order to actually count those votes, the machine produces a barcode or a QR code, you know, one of those computer-readable but not human-readable codes. And there's a fight now, right now, going on in Georgia because Georgia is saying the barcode is what controls. Doesn't matter what the name is on the piece of paper. And so that seems to me to be very troubling because if somebody controls the software code that counts the barcodes and you can't verify it and it doesn't even count if you could verify it with an actual piece of paper. That seems to me to be problematic, especially because, as you say, these machines are made by private companies. We don't have full government control over everything that's going into them. And so we need an external check on them. That, I think, is a good way to go. Los Angeles County went a different way. They're owning their own voting machines, and they're going to make it like a kind of open source sourceware. They're the largest electoral jurisdiction in the country, and they're going to try and sell them to other electoral jurisdictions to try and make it more of a public resource than a product of a private for-profit company. That may be the wave of the future.
A few years ago, there was concern about the machines created by Diebold.
Yes.
Now, are they still in the business of creating these machines?
So these were electronic machines for the most part. And the reason it was so controversial is the head of Diebold was a supporter of George W. Bush and said something like, we're going to deliver the election for you. And he was talking about as a donor to the campaign, but many people took that as a statement about the machines. It seems to me back in 2012, I was actually talking to you about an earlier book I wrote called The Voting Wars, and it seemed to me there was a lot of hysteria about voting machines and there wasn't that much to be concerned about. But I've since become much more concerned myself, in part because even though Diebold is not around anymore, some of the leading manufacturers of these machines invest in heavy lobbying of election officials. You know, they don't reveal their source code. There was an election contest about a decade ago in Florida, and the company wouldn't reveal its trade secrets. And so if you can't get into the kind of the back of the machine into the software, you can't verify that. That's why you need an external way to verify the vote, like a piece of paper that can be recounted by human beings to make sure that votes are being fairly and accurately counted.
Okay, let's also talk about the people involved in elections. And let's go first to North Carolina.
It's a swing state. There's a lot of partisanship going on. The legislature has engaged in passing laws that make it harder for some people to register and vote. You may remember that this big restrictive election law in North Carolina, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit struck it down as targeting African-American voters with almost surgical precision. There's fights over voting machines there too. But I have to say that I think that the state did pretty well in dealing with actual election fraud that occurred in the 2018 election. This is like the first case in many years of documented election fraud involving North Carolina's 9th congressional district. This was the race where there was ballot tampering with absentee ballots.
Who was on the ballot?
These were two candidates. Don McCready was the Democrat and Mark Harris was the Republican. And in the last primary he had run in, Harris got almost no absentee votes. So he hired the guy that got almost all the absentee votes for his opponent the last time. Turns out this person who's now under indictment allegedly had been hiring people to collect absentee ballots in violation of North Carolina law, perhaps stealing ballots, changing votes, voting ballots. And so even in areas with a Democratic majority, the Republican was getting all of these votes. There was a kind of a bipartisan investigation. Unanimously, the State Board of Elections agreed there had to be a new election, and they held a new election. A different Republican ran against McCready. He won the election, but everyone believes that election was done fairly. So that was, in North Carolina, that was a good instance of people acting fairly. So sometimes people do rise above their partisan positions and do what's best for, the people of their state in terms of running elections.
And what did Donald Trump have to say about that election?
Well, surprisingly, had very little to say about that election. He was pressed by Hallie Jackson, the White House reporter for NBC News, about it. And he pivoted immediately to talking about California, saying there was a million fraudulent votes there. He pivoted to talking about voter fraud in Texas, where there are allegations of 58,000 non-citizens voting. Jackson tried to push him and say, those aren't real cases. I'm talking about an actual case. And Trump wouldn't talk about that. He said, I condemn all fraud. Trump has repeatedly made claims that voter fraud is rampant. He famously said that there were 3 to 5 million fraudulent votes cast, all for his opponent, in the 2016 presidential election. It's so odd to have the winner of the election calling into question its legitimacy. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think it's probably not a coincidence that 3 million is not just the number of voters that Trump pointed to, but the number by which he lost the popular vote.
Talk about Kris Kobach as Secretary of State in Kansas.
So Kobach was the leaders of what I've called the fraudulent fraud squad. He's one of the people who's gone around saying that voter fraud is an epidemic. And the book actually opens in chapter one by talking about what I consider to be the most important voting rights trial so far of the 21st century, where the question at issue was how much non-citizen voter fraud is there and how much is a law that required, a Kansas law requiring people to provide documentary proof of citizenship, like a birth certificate or naturalization certificate, before they could register to vote. How much is that necessary to prevent voter fraud? And so here was the case actually put on trial in front of a federal district court judge. Here was Kobach's chance to put it on evidence, and it was an embarrassment. He was sanctioned multiple times by the judge, including ordered by the court to go to continuing legal education classes to learn how to conduct a trial, which is pretty embarrassing for a lawyer. But here was his chance. He said that what he had shown so far about non-citizen voting was the tip of the iceberg. And the judge in the end said, there is no iceberg. There's only an icicle. And time and again, these voter fraud claims have collapsed. But now, with that and the commission that the president established, the Pence-Kobach Commission to look into supposed voter fraud, between those two things, I think we can safely put to bed the argument that voter fraud is an epidemic in this country. The intellectual argument for it has really collapsed when it's been examined in a court of law and in the court of public opinion.
I'm looking at the tweet that Ken Paxton in Texas put out, a voter fraud alert. Where did that come from?
So this comes after the trial, right? After the Kobach Commission has collapsed, when I think all reasonable people would agree that voter fraud is not a major problem in this country. And yet Texas announced that something like 95,000 non-citizens were on their voting rolls and up to 58,000 people who are non-citizens had voted in Texas elections. If that were true, that would be a major scandal, the largest voter fraud scandal in modern American history. Well, it turns out that what Texas did was they had matched their voter registration list with a list of non-citizens and citizens, but the list was 7 years old, and about 1 million people in Texas became naturalized during that period. So virtually everyone on that list of those supposed non-citizen voters were all citizens at the time that they voted. A different federal district judge came in and said, this is your mess. He quoted All I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten and said, clean up your own messes. Again, nothing proven. Texas had to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees to the voting rights lawyers that had to bring a lawsuit against this. And yet that tweet that you read, I think it had something like 85,000 likes and many thousands of shares the last time I checked. Never been removed. No apology. You know, the president's tweeted about this. The governor, Greg Abbott of Texas, has tweeted about this. And so, you know, if you're looking at what they're saying, there's never been a retraction. And so people are going to think, well, you know, this is legitimate, when in fact it's been proven that, you know, it is, again, an icicle.
So, Rick, how do you see this? Is it an effort simply to suppress voting?
Well, there are certain things that have to be done that can have a suppressive effect, like cleaning voting rolls. People move, people die, they have to be removed from the voting rolls. And we don't have a great system in place everywhere for doing that. But I think many of these laws, laws that restrict early voting, laws that make you show your papers before you can register, all of those kinds of things, I think the intention is to make it harder to register and vote. There's a reason that these laws are almost always proposed by Republicans who believe, I think, that having a smaller electorate is going to be to their advantage electorally. And I don't believe that these laws always have a suppressive effect. For example, I think that voter ID laws probably suppress less of the vote than many Democrats believe, because there are lots of countermeasures that are taken and because lots of people who don't have IDs tend to not vote anyway. But it seems to me that asks the wrong question. The question is not, do they affect election outcomes? Do they affect turnout on a large scale? But does the state have a good reason for making it harder for an otherwise eligible voter to be able to register and vote? And the answer is usually the state doesn't have a good reason. Those who are doing it to try to secure electoral advantage.
So we are seeing new laws on the books that, in effect, will lower the turnout?
Well, sometimes I think we don't know if they will lower the turnout. Voter ID laws, the studies show a small effect. But let's take the documentary proof of citizenship law in Kansas as another example. We know that before the ACLU and others went in to sue over that law, 30,000 people had their voter registrations put on a suspense list. They were not allowed to vote. And they would have not been allowed to vote. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't go around everywhere with my birth certificate. I certainly wouldn't have it if I'm at the DMV and I'm there registering to vote. Lots of people can't even find their birth certificate or their naturalization certificate. You know, it's not the kind of thing that people have handy. And so, you know that of those 30,000 people, many of them would have ended up not voting. So it could affect turnout, but more importantly, and I've spoken to lawyers who've represented some of these people who've had their registrations put on hold or who were not allowed to vote because of an ID law, they feel that they've lost their dignity because they're being put through, you know, a kind of inquisition when really all they're trying to do is do the same thing that the rest of us who are American citizens want to do, which is cast a ballot for the candidates that we prefer.
A quick break. When we come back, more from Richard Hasson.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Richard Hasson. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Talk about Brenda Snipes, the former Democratic election official in Broward County, Florida.
So we've been talking a lot now about voter suppression, and I think it's a kind of a sexy issue in the election world. But if you talk about why your vote might not be counted, it's probably more likely that your vote won't be counted if you happen to live in a place with poor election administration. And Brenda Snipes, who was a Democratic election official, reelected to her office numerous times, had just a series of mistakes and problems in how her office administered the election. So in one election, her office failed to send out 58,000 absentee ballots to people who requested them. In another election, she left a medical marijuana initiative off the ballot. In another election, she released absentee vote results early. In another election, she destroyed ballots after the election and didn't hold them for 22 months as required by federal law. So one thing after another. It really came to a head in the 2018 election. You may remember in Florida, it was very close between Rick Scott, the incumbent governor who was running for U.S. Senate against incumbent Democratic Governor Bill Nelson. The election went to a recount. It was a strict time deadline for running the recount. And the state imposed this deadline, and Broward County, even though they finished their counting, they couldn't submit their vote totals in time. They were 2 minutes late because they didn't know how to operate the website where they would have submitted the vote totals. And then after that, the county board thought that the recount was done in such a shoddy way that they voted not to even submit those later numbers in a further recount because they thought they were inaccurate. Across the state of Florida, right, we're talking almost 20 years after Bush versus Gore and the Florida debacle then, thousands of votes were lost between the count and the recount. And there's just so many places in this country where there are still problems, often in big cities, often with Democratic majorities, where these votes are not being counted.
You talk about one of what you call the most despicable moments in modern American politics. In 2018, with then Georgia Secretary of State, now Governor Brian Kemp.
Right, so Brian Kemp was, as you said, both running the election and running for election. Right, that's how we do it in this country. We let partisan election officials run their own elections, which is that's not the most despicable thing. That's business as usual. What was crazy here was that Kemp had a history of problems. I think if Brenda Snipes was the most inept, famous local election official, Kemp was the most famous statewide election official. And one of the problems perennially they had was with their voter registration database. It was being run by a state university, and they had all kinds of security problems with it. And they said they had fixed those problems. There had been lawsuits over it. And then about a week before the election, a private citizen who I think was a software engineer, he went to check his voter registration information on the state's website, which you can do to make sure you're all set and ready to vote. And he noticed that the way they had set up the website, with a few changes of the keystrokes, he could get anyone's voter registration information in the state of Georgia. And, it was completely not a secure site. Any file, he could pull down any file that was on this state
so he could
website.
See those.
He could see people's names.
He couldn't
change them, but he could get in and he could see the files, and potentially then, you know, you can change the files. But what he did was he alerted some lawyers who were involved in the lawsuits against Georgia for how they were running their elections, and he alerted the Democratic Party's election protection hotline. So someone there spoke to her supervisor. They called some computer scientists at Georgia Tech, who then reported it to law enforcement authorities. And what you'd think would happen next would be that they would fix the problem. Instead, Brian Kemp announced an investigation into hacking by the Democratic Party of Georgia into the voting machines. And he put this allegation, which is completely unfounded and meant to cover up his misfeasance, he put that allegation on the front page of the official Secretary of State of Georgia's website. It went up on Saturday, the Saturday before the Tuesday of the election, and it stayed up for days. So voters who would go to that website to find out, where do I vote? What are the issues on the ballot this year? This is what they would see under news on the very front, two stories about Democrats being referred to law enforcement officials for hacking into the election. I mean, it was really a despicable moment. And, you know, he's doing it to cover up his own problems, and he's doing it in a way that I think tries to put in the worst light his political opponent. I mean, this really does not sound like the stuff you'd see in a democracy. This sounds like the stuff you'd see where someone's trying to mess with the election.
So, Rick, you say you believe the safest form of election process would be that paper ballot where a pencil is used to fill in that little space for the candidate you want. How many states are currently using paper ballots?
Well, we can't even talk by state because our elections are not run by state. They're run on a county level. So we have something like on election day, 8,000 or 9,000 different election jurisdictions. And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I don't even think half are using just the paper ballot with the Scantron now. I mean, there's just all kinds of different formats for voting. And so there's a great federal experiment where we and decentralization where we let states and localities do different things. This is an area where we shouldn't, where we should have a national standard. And we have certain standards that were imposed after the 2000 election that require the ability to do recounts. But the way those have been interpreted, in fact, some recounts can be meaningless, as we discussed about these barcodes. I mean, if all you're going to do is run things through a machine again or push a button again, that's not really a meaningful way to count votes.
So as you look at the decentralization of this voting process, do we need to move to a different kind of system altogether?
Well, I think long term, it would make sense to join other countries like Australia, Canada, Germany, France, the UK, right? All of these places have national civil servants, nonpartisan election officials running elections. And so if you're in a polling place in one part of the country or the other, the machinery is going to be the same, the rules are going to be the same, and it's not going to be politicized. That's the long-term goal, I think, is to move to professional nonpartisan election administration where it's not run locally. And yet, we're so far from that. After 2000, things have actually gotten more politicized. States have more power now than they used to over localities, but the federal government's role is really quite limited. Thinking about November 2020, there's no way we're going to make any significant changes on that level. So that's more of a long-term issue. I think what we have to focus on are how do we deal with these weak links? How do we deal with places like Broward County, Florida, or Detroit, where they had a debacle of a recount in 2016? Or how do we deal with Georgia that can't keep its voter registration database secure? What can we do in the next 9-10 months to ensure that we have a successful election?
What about outside interference from countries like Russia?
In 2016, we saw three kinds of Russian interference. Right? One was misinformation and the provocations that were put on social media, you know, trying to convince people to vote one way or trying to convince African Americans not to vote at all, trying to depress turnout. We saw a domestic group supporting Doug Jones for U.S. Senate, the Democratic candidate against Roy Moore, emulate those same strategies, trying to depress the turnout of moderate Republicans in Alabama in 2017 in the special U.S. Senate election to replace Jeff Sessions. So we're going to see that foreign and domestic attempts at misinformation on social media. There's not much the government can do because of the First Amendment, but there's a lot that the companies can do, like Facebook and Twitter and Google, to try to flag misinformation and try to shut down bot accounts that try to send that out. So one thing is a misinformation. I expect we're going to see more of it. And I think that convinces people that everything they see is false, and that has its own problems. The second thing we saw the Russians do was hacking into voter registration databases. They tried across the country. In a few instances, it looks like they went in and changed some information, which then got caught. We don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes, but it does seem like the federal government is working with states and many localities who are willing to work with the federal government to try to prevent hacking into machines. But we need to have contingency plans for dealing with that. And one of the biggest hacks I'm worried about, and I describe this in Election Meltdown, is what if the electrical grid were hacked in a Democratic city in a swing state like Michigan or Wisconsin? And then the third thing that the Russians did was stealing private emails and releasing them. And already this talk that the Russians have broken into Burisma, and so you might expect in October we'll see some Hunter Biden emails coming out. And what we saw in the French election after the 2016 U.S. election was that when the Russians went in and hacked into Macron's emails or the Macron party's emails, they put in some fake documents as well. Interspersed with the real stuff was fake stuff that could be inflammatory.
Saying what?
I don't recall what the specifics were, but to try to embarrass the party that Macron was leading. And I think we're going to see more of that in the upcoming election. And the question is, what are journalists going to do? Are they going to, one thing is, are you going to be more careful about reporting on leaked documents before you have verified their authenticity?
Rick, given all of this, you say that your biggest fear is what will happen after the 2020 election. What do you mean?
So there's a lot that can go wrong on election day, even putting aside the possibility of some kind of cyber attack or a natural disaster or something like that. Let me throw out a very plausible scenario. In the last year, Pennsylvania has changed a number of its election laws. Pennsylvania used to be a state like New York where there was no early voting. And now in Pennsylvania, I think this is a great improvement, you can now get a no-excuse absentee ballot. So anyone in the state, if you can't make it on election day, you don't want to wait in line for a long time, you can vote by absentee ballot. Well, we know it's going to take a really long time to count those absentee ballots. In California, it takes weeks and weeks because we have millions of ballots. And it takes a long time to check to make sure that the signatures match. It's much faster to just count votes at the polling place. If you're going to do absentee ballots, it takes much longer to process. So we already know that it's going to take days to finish counting in Pennsylvania. Trump could be ahead in Pennsylvania on the night of the election, and he could declare victory, only to see his lead evaporate. Because we know in the last few elections, we saw this in California, especially in 2018, we have what Professor Ned Foley has called the big blue shift. Those late votes, those absentee and provisional votes, tend to trend Democratic. So we could see Trump declare victory on election night and say, stop the counting. The rest of the ballots that would be counted would be fraud. He made this exact claim in 2018 in the Rick Scott, Bill Nelson, Florida race. He said, must go with election night. Other ballots massively infected. Those were his words. And so you can imagine Trump saying he's the victor. And eventually Pennsylvania election officials say, no, the Democratic opponent is the victor. You could have Trump trying to pressure the Pennsylvania legislature to produce a second slate of electors for the Electoral College and leave this to Congress, where, as you may remember, if you go back to your elementary school civics class, in the event of a dispute over the Electoral College votes, the House decides, but not on a one House member, one vote rule. Under a each state House delegation gets one vote rule. And because there are more Republican state delegations than there are Democratic delegations, even if Trump lost Pennsylvania, he could win Pennsylvania in the counting in the House. And then, you can imagine it wouldn't be that Trump's not leaving office, which is something many Democrats are concerned about.
Well, let's look at the other scenario where Trump loses.
Yes.
Then what happens?
Well, so then, ordinarily what happens is there's a peaceful transition of power and Trump would work with the successor and they would transfer power on January 20th, 2021. There's all kinds of concerns. What would the military do if Trump doesn't leave office? And I think so much of this—
If he doesn't leave office, yes. What does that mean?
He refuses to leave the White House. You know, many people have told me that this is what they expect would happen. And so here, it would depend upon, I think, what congressional leaders would do. And given the performance in the recent impeachment trial in the Senate, I'm concerned about whether the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and others in the party would go along with, if Trump has a plausible basis to claim that he won, even if he lost, for him to try to remain in office. I mean, that is a real nightmare scenario where I think you'd see people taking to the streets, and it would just be, you know, the very collapse of the kind of system that we've had of peaceful transitions of power in this country for, you know, well over a century. I mean, you'd have to go back to 1876 to, you know, talk about protracted disputes, you know, that really threatened the country much more than 2000.
How realistic do you believe that fear is?
Well, as I said at the beginning, just like with a nuclear meltdown, you've got to take precautions if there's a small chance of a huge catastrophe. I think that's the same thing here. The best case scenario for how we don't have a problem is something that's completely out of our control, which is that we don't have a close election. There's the election administrator's prayer, Lord, let this election not be close. If it's a blowout, then I think it would be much harder for the losing party to claim victory. If it's very close, if there are problems in how the election was run that could be exploited by internal or external forces, I think that makes it much more possible that we go into overtime and that we have social unrest.
Do you have a prediction?
For the results of the election? At this point, you know, I certainly don't. And, you know, I don't see myself as an expert pollster. I think the common wisdom is it's going to come down to the same set of states, maybe add in Arizona this time around. So we're talking Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. And as I detail in Election Meltdown, there are issues in each of these states. And it could be that within a few weeks, the Supreme Court is going to get involved in a case out of Arizona involving one of their laws about collecting absentee ballots that the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit just held was unconstitutional. This is a law that barred the collection of these ballots. And so the courts are going to be thrust into this mess as well. So my short answer is I don't know what's going to happen in 2020. My focus now is thinking about what can we do in the next few months to try to minimize the chances that we have a catastrophe.
When you began this book, were you as concerned then as you are now?
That's a good question. I think probably I'm more concerned now than I was even when I started this book. What first got me interested in this is I recall in January 2009, when George W. Bush peacefully handed over power to Barack Obama, you know, conservative Republican to liberal Democrat. And I remarked on my blog at the time that it's remarkable that we have these peaceful transitions and everyone takes it for granted. And when I saw Trump in 2016 make this statement, when he refused to say that he would accept the election results, Hillary Clinton won, he gave a speech where he says, you know, in this very serious voice, ladies and gentlemen, I solemnly swear and promise to you that I will accept the results of the election. And then he paused for a second, looks at the camera and says, if I win, with a big grin on his face. You know, it's a big joke. I've counted 27 times where Trump has joked or remarked about staying in office for more than two terms. So as this goes on with Trump making these comments, I think both Democrats and Republicans are getting very concerned, right? Trump is making people concerned that Democrats are going to try and steal the election. Democrats are concerned that Trump's not leaving. I hear it all the time. And so it's just very volatile. And it doesn't seem that things are calming down. I think impeachment has only gotten people more polarized in thinking about the president.
Rick Hessen, thank you for your work. And thank you for being here.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urib-Lipker and Cliff Gallagher. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.